Oh, and welcome to another special edition of Football Memories and Moments. This time we're looking at the best of Series 2. I think we're going to go back and do Series 1 when we get the chance as well. This series kicked off with a fantastic chat with Jonathan Northcroft from the Sunday Times. It finished with an all right chat with us, actually. We were quite happy with it due to some technical issues around some other pods. We had an emotional chat with Paul Kendrick ahead of the walk for Joseph's goal. We also spoke to David Squires. We spoke to Andy Brassel, Derek Ray, as well as Pat Nevin. That was a fantastic chat. And yeah, if you enjoy our chat and you're listening to them on Apple Podcasts, we really would be really grateful if you could rate 5 stars and just get us up those charts and get these chats noticed. But yeah, on with the best of Series 2.
It's a brilliant goal. So, I mean, in my sort of long-winded scene set I was giving you there, I was trying to explain how good Bayern Munich were and how good our result was away from home. But they were still the favourites. And Klaus Augenthaler just kind of emphasised that by scoring this fabulous goal that you just didn't really see in Scottish football at the time. And the thing about Aberdeen in Europe, you know, we'd become the best team in Scotland, but we'd had some pretty hefty reminders of how far we actually still had to go in Europe. So a big point in the club's history was being sort of demolished really by the great Liverpool side in 1980. You know, we were Scottish champions. We met Liverpool in the European Cup, just didn't lay a glove on them. They were far better. And we'd had those sort of reminders. And then this Klaus Augenthaler goal, I suppose, just brought it all back. You know, we'd turned up thinking we've got a chance here, and it just seemed to remind you how good they were. And I remember that was in the context of a very controlled first half from Bayern. They scored early. It's a lovely goal, and then they settled in the game and dominated it for a good sort of half an hour, 40 minutes.
But then Augenthaler turns from hero for Bayern's sake, and flip side, he goes from hero because he must be watching that, or he must not be watching it. But what I'm saying is that he would have seen that and gone, why didn't I just clear it?
I know. I think it was part of the comfort that Bayern Munich were enjoying in the game, and they just had this class about them, and maybe they were starting to underestimate Aberdeen. I know from I've actually written about this and spoken to people at the Bayern Munich end. They clearly expected to win, and maybe they were a bit complacent, and maybe Augenthaler was infected a little bit by that. But you know, I think we forced that goal, that equaliser that we're about to talk about. We just forced that. You know, when it's a bit like Wigan in the FA Cup the other night against City. Sometimes a smaller club can just, you know, if the fans are in the right mood and there's enough energy on the pitch, they can just force situations. And I think this goal was a classic example. Forced a mistake from a great player and then capitalised.
The United game in March was one of the craziest games I've ever been to. People probably remember it for the for Cantona being sent off for stamping on John Moncur. Yeah. Earlier in the game, a Swindon fan had delivered an open hand slap to the face of Mark Hughes. That was only about 15 meters in front of me, and this massive, looked like a sort of agricultural worker just strode forward and slapped Hughes around the face as he bundled into the crowd. It was just bizarre, but I mean, that's the sort of thing that would probably see a game abandoned now, and perhaps rightly so, but it was nuts. And the United players came over and then they saw the size of the gentleman who had delivered the slap and sort of retreated to a safe distance. So there was that. And then after just coming out the ground afterwards, a 2-2 draw. And I just came out to like a scene from Braveheart. You know, there was horses and there was just a huge scrap. Unfortunately, someone punched my friend Dave in the nose, and he was only 16 at the time. And he went into the back of an ambulance and went off to A&E, and he was sat in there with a police dog handler who had released his dog and watched the Alsatian run in a huge circle around the melee and then just come back and bite him on his own hand. So he was in there as well. But it was It was just a nuts day. Like, this is sort of a minor claim to fame, but Swindon were the only team who scored two goals at Old Trafford that season. We did the double over QPR. QPR, mind. Yeah. We took 4 points off Spurs. We also had a 2-2 draw at Liverpool, which is commonly amongst Swindon fans, that's sort of known as one of our most famous results in our history.
Well, because I grew up in South East London, actually, everyone in my school supported Liverpool pretty much, as was normal in the 80s, when you were growing up in the 80s. I didn't want to do that. My mum wouldn't let me go to Millwall. I never really fancied Crystal Palace or Charlton. So I ended up going to Wimbledon because I was always curious. I mean, they were in the second tier when I started to, I suppose, support Wimbledon when I was like 7 or 8 years old. And I wanted to support someone who was different. And I was curious to how a team that whose name was associated with something else, tennis, of course, had got up to the second tier. Of course, I didn't know the top tier, and a long spell at the top tier was just around the corner when I started to take an interest in them. And I was made to wait as well. My dad worked Saturdays when I was 7, 8 years old, so I couldn't go. Then he was out of work for a year, so we definitely couldn't go. But after that, when he got a job when I was 10, almost 11, I got to go the first time. And there was never any doubt. I mean, there was never any doubt in my mind that I would be a Wimbledon supporter anyway. When I got to my first game, which was 1987 in the school holidays, it was August, against Everton, who were the Division One top flight champions at the time. Alan Cork scored in the first half of Wimbledon, and they conceded a late equaliser to Graham Sharp. But everything about it was incredible.
I have to be honest with you, the biggest effect anything ever had on me was I was playing for Chelsea, and it was just after my first season, nearly end of my first season. And I used to walk to the games, which is hilarious now when you consider it, what the players deal with. So I lived in Ells Court at the time, so I walked down to the game, which is, I mean, I was player of the year that year. It just shows you how mad football has changed in that short period of time. And we went in, and, you know, we played and we won, and it was a good game, and I scored. And I thought I'd just walk back home afterwards. Yeah, it's only about a 10-minute walk, it's fine. And I quite often just bumped into fans as walking, and they knew that I was just kind of a normal bloke, and it was perfectly fine. But as I was walking along this particular day, this old guy just kind of walked in step with me, which some people just did, you know, and had a quick chat. And he said, you're Nevin, aren't you? And I went, yeah. And he said, I came out to see you today. I don't go out much anymore, and I don't go much football, but I'd heard you're a skillful player and a dribbler, and I came out to see you today. And I said, you enjoy it? And he goes, yeah, had a good time. And I went to I went to talk to him more about it, and he just walked away. And it was like. I was always dedicated to every game I ever played. I just thought, that is the reason why I play football, more than anything else. To show, to entertain, number one, to, you know, show that you're capable of creating something that people will want to see and enjoy in the midst of it all. And the big thing about it is, I might never have bumped into that guy. And he'd made the effort, and he'd had a good day out. And it had given him a happy weekend. Now, that was just one guy. Now, that might be lots of people who you'll never... And it is lots of people you'll never meet.
Well, yes, the oldest international fixture that there is. And I think you have to say that back in the 80s, you know, anybody who's, you know, younger listening to this probably thinks England, Scotland, OK, it sounds pretty good. But, I mean, that was certainly a Scots. That was the game. That was the game. It was on television, live, every single year. It meant something back then. Now, it was starting to sort of be less relevant in the sense that this was a midweek game and not a weekend game. So you could sort of see that the trend was there towards the diminishing of this fixture. This was part of the Rouse Cup, as it was called, and then it became more than just Scotland and England, and then it went away altogether, which I think is very sad. Still to this day, I think it's very sad that the oldest international fixture is not played more regularly. But at that time, it was highly significant. And so I went down and I did the game, worked with John Gregg, the former Scotland captain, and actually with Mike Ingham as well, who is a fabulous broadcaster, who many of you will know, who's now retired and I think living in Cornwall very happily. But Mike was the other commentator on the days when you would do 22 and a half minutes each. It was one of these little quirks of BBC radio for many years and decades that you would have two commentators. One would start it, the other would finish the half, and then the same in the second half, and you'd have a summariser, and it was John Gregg. So, I mean, this was my first trip to Wembley. I'd never been to an England-Scotland game before, not even as a fan. I mean, we lived in Aberdeen, Glasgow was 3 hours away, and my focus as a youngster was probably more on my local team, Aberdeen, than it was on the national team, although I cared passionately about Scotland doing well and followed them, of course, on television at every major tournament back when they were qualifying for the World Cup pretty much all the time. So did the game, and again, I think it went pretty well. And, you know, I could take you through the football side of it, but for me, it was all a bit of a blur because you're focusing on the commentary. You're focusing on your part of it. And, you know, I was introduced to all the grandees, all the greats of Radio 2 at the time, Peter Jones, the late Peter Jones, Brian Butler, the football correspondent, Ron Greenwood, who was, of course, the former England manager and was working for BBC Radio at the time. And again, I was just sort of trying to worry about my little part of it. But, you know, again, I was pinching myself because here I was in the main press box at Wembley looking down at the action, and it was all there in front of me. And, you know, you said it's a bit like somebody who's only had a bit of work experience getting the big job. It was somebody at Radio Scotland. It was actually a guy called Stan Taylor, who was the head of Radio Scotland, who came up with, I think, the best line of all on that front. He said, it's a bit like, you know, somebody who's in the chorus line, you know, getting the big part as the lead voice in a musical production. The difference is, he said, you weren't even in the chorus line until last week.
So we started a charity called Joseph's Goal, completely family run. Just whenever we get a spare minute, we just sort of got involved. Initially, it was just a bike ride, a Wigan Athletic bike ride to one of the away games. I think it was at Norwich. No, sorry, it was Arsenal. Funnily enough, the cup final weekend in 2013, so we'd been planning for months for it. And as we got nearer to the thing, it just took on a life of its own, and we were getting people saying, you need to make this a real charity rather than just a one-off event. Obviously, Wigan Athletic being Wigan Athletic, they completely messed it up by getting to the cup final, so we had to. There's a theme running through this of Wigan Athletic messing things up in a brilliant way, but obviously, the cup final took precedent, the game was postponed, and by that time, we were obviously a fully fledged charity. The club, absolutely fantastic from day one. And it was actually Roberto Martinez's idea who said, you know, we need to get Joseph involved. I think he understood, being the great man he is, the magnitude and the awareness and the profile that we could get for it. So he sort of said, yeah, we'd like to get him involved as mascot. And that was amazing, and turning up on the day at Wembley, in the dressing room beforehand, going through the dress rehearsal. He was in a wheelchair by that point, and we did all the dress rehearsal. Emerson Boyce was going to push him out at the front of the queue. And just waiting in the tunnel, both teams came out before the game, and Boyce just came over and said, do you mind if I carry him out? He's one of us, kind of thing. And we were just absolutely, you know, it was an emotional day anyway, but absolutely blown away by this sort of gesture, you know, showing what a great, you know, just a human being he is. He didn't want to push him out, he wanted to carry him. And obviously, he didn't know it, but Joe, on the back of his shirt, had Joseph's Goal written on the back of his shirt, which obviously, when Boyce carries him out face to face, you've got this image being beamed around a billion people watching on TV. So from that day, the charity just went from being a local regional cause to a national and international one. And we had people getting in touch, you know, we've seen it, we're in Asia, we're in Australia, Canada, this amazing moment, what can we do? We had a website by that point, so they'd obviously Googled us and found us, and it's just been that way since. People just from right at the beginning we were begging people, can you donate, can you do stuff for us? And it got to the point after that where people were coming to us saying, I've seen this cause, I'd really like to get involved. And that day kind of teleported it from, you know, a small time operation to a really big thing.
Most charities have a race night or a car wash. You had an FA Cup final.
Yeah.
That's not a bad way to do it, is it?
No.
So Atkinson goes over to take the corner and swings it in, and we see Gordon Armstrong. Gordon Armstrong had this massive shiny forehead, and it was like the perfect forehead. So you know how Trevor Stephen had a massive shiny forehead, which made him really good in the air? Gordon Armstrong, same thing. Big, shiny, ball-heading forehead. Goes up, heads it. And we're at the other end of the pitch. We're two-thirds of the way back in the full end. So pretty much as far as you can be from it. And we see that he's caught it nicely. And we've seen Gordon Armstrong do this before. And you can see Dave Besant diving to his right. And you can see the ball looping. And you're thinking, it's going in, it's going in. It's going to go over his hand. He's not going to get there. He's not going to get. And at the same time, you're going, why is he not in yet? This is taking forever. What's going on? Like, this doesn't. Someone's not right here. And then you see the Roker end behind that goal, which is all Chelsea fans. You see that just slump. And then the paddocks go up. And then we realise it has actually gone in, and we go up. And it was only when I got home and saw it on telly that I realised why it had taken so long to go in. Which is a Gordon Armstrong was, I don't know, 16 yards out, something like that. He was miles out. Huge celebrations. And the thing I remember, and I think this is the way you always really can assess just how good an atmosphere is, it's not the noise, it's the silence. So at the end of every line of a song, you had this absolute perfect pin drop silence because everybody was singing. And I was sort of thrown 20 yards forward and kind of making my way back up the full end, and everybody was going mad. And sort of by the time I finally sort of retake my, get back on my feet and looking at the game again, the ball's played into the Sunderland box and it's half cleared, and Vinnie Jones is moving on to it. And John Kay, who was our hard man fullback. Now, John Kay is one of the great legends of Sunderland of that era. Never scored a goal for us. We'd signed him from Wimbledon. He was a very small man. He's probably, I don't know, 5'4", something like that. But so really, just small. Like, he wasn't like short and stocky. He was tiny, but the hardest man I've ever seen. And so the two stories about his hardness. A few years later, he broke his leg. I can't remember who was against the game. It was a game, the team went blue at Loughborough Park. Broke his leg badly. And, it's obviously a bad injury. And they put him on the stretcher and his leg's in one of those, the plastic sheaths to kind of, keep it steady and everything. And as he's going off and he goes, there's a sort of the sympathetic applause. He sits up and pretends to be kayaking.